There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at all the grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesenell, and I'm your host. Eric Yurnell is at the controls. On today's program, it sounds like the FCC is starting to get a little soft on letting some consolidation go past. And though it looks like they might have a pretty good broadband plan in front of them, all that and more, we're going to catch up on the news. Do stay tuned. Well, this week we're going to take a rundown of the news. We haven't done that in a couple of weeks. Had some good interviews the last couple of weeks. And it's something I like to do because so much of news about communications policy, about legislation, even about the internet, still ends up being covered as a business story, as if this is something which is only important to people who are investing in the market or who are working in the market. But not as if it's important to our very democracy, our ability to communicate, our ability to share stories, to share truths, and to receive good communications. The internet has brought us so much of that capacity in the last 25 years. We've been able to do it through grassroots media, but we have to protect our ability to continue to use these media for our best common interests. So that's why I try to cover a lot of news here on Media Geek. We don't want to take it for granted. And today, if you have any comments about the program, please do tweet them along to me. If you use Twitter, go to twitter.com/MediaGeek. And if you're a user of the service, got any comments or questions about the program, send them to me. I will be going through some live on the air. Already, I sent out a question earlier in the week, whether, apropos with a story coming up in a moment, whether you think that newspapers could get saved by being bought by television stations or broadcast stations. If you have a comment about that, tweet it along, twitter.com/MediaGeek, or send me an email, paul@MediaGeek.net. On March 31st, the city of Chicago earned the dubious distinction of having both major daily newspapers and its largest alternative weekly newspaper all having declared bankruptcy. The Sun-Times Media Group filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, seeking the opportunity to restructure its $801 million in debt. Currently, the company lists $479 million in assets. Although the Sun-Times has undoubtedly suffered from the same economic factors as other newspapers, it is also hurting from millions of dollars siphoned from the company by convicted felon Conrad Black, now in prison for fraud. The Sun-Times Media Group used to be known as Hollinger International under Black's leadership, and the company was drained not just from Black's theft, but also from the legal costs of defending Black and other members of his management team. The company also owes as much as $608 million to the IRS in back taxes and penalties related to Conrad Black's business practices, though the company is appealing these charges. But the bleeding for Black isn't done yet. A Delaware corporate law judge ruled last year that the Sun-Times Media Group is still on the hook to pay Black's legal bills until he has exhausted his appeal process. As of September 2008, Sun-Times has paid out $118 million to defend Black and other former execs, and there's no way to predict how much larger the bill could grow. Black's attorneys have petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to turn out his conviction, arguing that jury instructions during his trial were flawed. Although Sun-Times has spent more than $200 million in legal fees associated with the fraud, altogether, the Sun-Times has spent more than $200 million in legal fees associated with the fraud perpetuated by Conrad Black and his cronies. Still, the debt isn't all Black's fault, even if he made significant contributions. Like the other newspaper owners in Chicago and elsewhere, the Sun-Times took on quite a bit of debt in order to go on an aggressive buying spree. In the Sun-Times case, it bought up suburban papers all around the Chicago area, only to be forced to shutter many in the last year. And for the record, owner Zell Miller took an incredible amount of debt to leverage his buyout of the Tribune Company, and Atlanta-based Creative Loafing also took on some $100 million in debt to acquire the weekly Chicago Reader and another alternative weekly. That's debt that has now forced both companies into bankruptcy. And it looks like all this trouble in newspaper land, from the Chicago newspaper bankruptcies to the closing of the Rocky Mountain News and Seattle Post-Intelligencer, is starting to soften up the acting chairman of the FCC, Commissioner Michael Copps. Up to now, Copps, a Democrat in the minority at the commission until President Obama took office, has been a vociferous opponent of relaxing media ownership rules. In particular, he opposed the FCC's 2007 decision to relax the cross-ownership rule, which limits the co-ownership of newspapers and television stations in the same market. Now he seems to be changing his stance, telling Bloomberg that the agency, quote, should visit this whole problem soon, end quote. This sentiment is being echoed by Attorney General Eric Holder and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who called for an examination to see if antitrust enforcement harms newspapers by preventing mergers. The FCC's 2007 ruling on cross-ownership is currently caught up in the courts with challenges from both sides, saying it both goes too far in loosening restrictions or that it doesn't go far enough. Republican FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell wrote a letter to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which is hearing the challenge, urging the court to expedite its decision. He suggested that broadcasters might be able to save some newspapers by acquiring them. However, the commission's other Democrat, Jonathan Adelstein, seems to be holding firm in his opposition to allowing more cross-ownership, saying, quote, given that the newspapers are in tough shape and the broadcasters are in tough shape, it doesn't seem like joining up two industries that have declining revenues, many of which are on the verge of bankruptcy, is going to save either one of them, end quote. Yet Adelstein's days in the FCC are numbered, as he has been tapped to head up the Rural Utilities Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There, Adelstein will oversee $2.5 billion in federal stimulus money to fund rural broadband development. Still, he needs to stick around the FCC at least until the nominee to be the new chair, Julius Genachowski, is finally confirmed by the Senate. Already down two members, the FCC requires three commissioners to have a quorum and conduct business. If Adelstein were to go, they'd be down to two, and things would be unusually quiet there at the commission. But back to newspapers. Regardless of what the FCC seems prepared to do, they aren't taking the economic beating lying down. Well, at least they're kicking and screaming on their way to the ground. On April 6th, the Associated Press, in effect the one big union for all newspapers, announced at its annual meeting that it would start taking a more aggressive stance against online sites it believes are appropriating its content without paying anything back. In comments made to the National Newspaper Association of America, AP Chairman William Dean Singleton seemed to be taking aim at the aggregation of AP content on the web that has generally been defended under the legal principle of fair use. In his keynote, Singleton said, quote, we can no longer stand by and watch others walk off with our work under misguided legal theories, end quote. Ars Technica writer Julian Sanchez points out that the AP is careful to use the word misappropriation in its arguments rather than the word infringement. You see, copyright infringement is soundly illegal when proven in court and can open up infringers to civil and criminal penalties. By contrast, misappropriation is a less severe doctrine developed by the Supreme Court in 1918 when deciding the case of a service that rewrote AP Wire stories of breaking news and then resold them. It didn't rise to the level of outright infringement, where the actual verbiage is utterly copied, but the justices believed it posed an economic threat if such so-called free writing were permitted. But the news itself can't be copyrighted. Facts is facts, and they don't belong to anyone. So the misappropriation doctrine is very narrow in scope, applying only to breaking news reporting that is somewhat exclusive in nature, meaning the AP has a reporter on the ground somewhere that no one else does. So the only way you'd hear about it is via the AP. In his Ars Technica article, Sanchez acknowledges that it's hard to determine how seriously one should take the AP's use of the word misappropriation. However, he does point out that the AP in the past tried to claim that bloggers should have to pony up $12.50 for quoting as few as 5 words from an AP article. Fair use be damned, apparently. Taking aim at the newspaper industry's belated attempt to strap on a pair is former print journalist, creator of the magazine Entertainment Weekly, and Medill School of Journalism grad Jeff Jarvis. Currently, Jarvis is a popular blogger and journalism professor at the City University of New York. He's been a prolific critic of the mainstream news industry for not having adequately or quickly embraced the opportunities offered by the online world. In a piece published at the Huffington Post on April 7th, Jarvis pens a speech he thinks the Newspaper Association of America should have heard. He starts out simply enough telling industry executives, "You blew it." Here's a further excerpt. Quote, "And now you're angry. Well, gentlemen," and that's pretty much all I see before me, angry old white men, "you have no right to anger. Instead, you are the proper objects of anger. The public should be angry with you for the poor stewardship you've exercised over the press and its service to society. Your journalists are angry at you for losing their jobs. Your pressmen and drivers and classified ad takers are angry at you for the same reason, and at the journalists for paying attention only to their own plight. Your advertisers were angry at you for using your monopolistic power to overcharge them and for providing inefficient platforms and bad service for so long. But they're not angry anymore, because they left you for better advertising vehicles and better prices in a competitive marketplace," end quote. And that's from Jeff Jarvis, blogger, journalist, and professor at the University of New York, in a piece published to the Huffington Post on April 7th. So here we are. Even one of the most outspoken critics of media consolidation at the FCC now seems to be getting a little soft, saying that maybe broadcasters, maybe the TV channels, which have been wanting to buy up newspapers, ought to be allowed to do so. Maybe that will help to save newspapers. The interesting thing is, one of the reasons why Tribune Company is on the ropes is that prior to being bought by Zell Miller, they had bet very heavily on the fact that they expected the FCC to dissolve the cross-ownership rule. And that's something we've talked about here on the show many times. So they went about buying up broadcast properties, hoping to combine them with their newspaper properties. Only the rule didn't change, and they took on a lot of debt, and it's arguable that even if the rule had changed and stuck, they'd still have all this debt and wouldn't be in a much better situation. In fact, someone else might argue that the reason why newspapers and the big broadcasters are in this predicament in the first place is because of consolidation, is because they leveraged themselves to hell and back with lots and lots of debt in order to go on buying sprees to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and now they're sort of rolling around under their own weight. It seems to be sort of counterlogical, counterintuitive to think that allowing them to get ever a little bit bigger would make them all the more sustainable. So I put this question out to listeners and to people out there in the Twitter sphere. What do y'all think? Do you think that perhaps if the Sun-Times could get bought up by a television station in Chicago, that might save it? Or if maybe the Rocky Mountain News had been able to be bought by a television station in Denver, and the Seattle Post Intelligencer got sold off to a television station in Seattle. Would that have saved them? Would they have been able to find some efficiencies, combine their newsrooms, cut back some more staff, some more salaries, and make some more hay? Eric, you got your mic on there.
I do, Paul. I just gotta bring something up. The Chicago Sun-Times, do you really think that would be so much of a loss if that happened to fold? I mean, I have respect for the people that work there and write for the Sun-Times, but it's kind of been drifting in kind of a tabloid direction for a while now. So maybe it should be bought up by, like the Weekly World News or something like that.
Well, I guess the question, one has to ask in that case is, what do we judge an importance of a newspaper on? It still does do reporting. They do still have occasionally break good stories on the front page, local stories. It does tend to have a more sensationalist bent on the front page. Although if you look at the Chicago Tribune more recently, It also tends to have a more sensationalist bent. If you look at a city like New York, you have still a good four daily newspapers with wide distribution. In the New York Post, the New York Daily News, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. Some more tabloidy and some not. Some might even argue that the division between tabloid and not tabloid is a class issue. The Sun-Times having often been thought of as the working class newspaper of Chicago. But arguably, there is still some competition and check on one another between the Tribune and the Sun-Times. Or you could say the same thing about the few cities left in the U.S. that have two newspapers, that they serve as a check on one another.
Now, I do appreciate and I like the format of the Sun-Times. I think that's a great idea.
You mean the tabloid format?
The tabloid format. Yeah. Specifically that. I know the New York Post also going there, and the Daily News.
And the Tribune recently started distributing a tabloid size format, especially in their paper machines in the public transport, so near the L lines and everything, so they moved to that. So, I think it's a matter of more choice in the marketplace, perhaps. Choose the paper that suits your style, especially if they both still have journalists on the ground. Because arguably, though, I would say the quality of journalism at both have been going downhill, largely because they've been de-investing in news. They've been de-investing in reporters shedding staff, largely to pay for their dalliances of going out and buying other newspapers and other properties. And this is, again, not at all exclusive to Chicago, the Sun-Times, or the Tribune Company. Of course, the Tribune Company owns papers around the country, most prominently the Los Angeles Times. Relatively recent acquisition for them. So anyway, I put out this question on the Twitter sphere here, and I got some answers.
Yep.
So we got Pirates Week. So twitter.com/Pirates Week. My pal Ragnar Dennisjold, who produces a podcast called The Pirates Week, all about shortwave piracy, shortwavepirate.info. He says, if that is the only model to save newspapers, cross-ownership that is it worth it? Further consolidation of media ownership and news sources? Tony Malloy on Twitter, so twitter.com/Tony Malloy, says, news info delivery moves inexorably to online media mobile channels. TV, paper, old media are equally at risk from this. And Jeffrey Miller, also on Twitter, says, I don't know if their fate is sealed, but the Barbarians have assumed positions as managers. Then we hear from Fun for All, who is also a pal of mine, Andrew O'Boyle, who has been on this program. He says, hardly. Some savings by merging newsrooms, perhaps, but it's not that margins in print are too small. It's that they're shrinking. And then I got an email response from Blahut, who was on the show back in January, who contributes to a blog called Retro Thing, all about retro technology. He writes, quote, to be honest, I don't know what benefit the consumer gets from combining TV and press. Of course, I have the fear that fewer sources of news are easier for some unscrupulous baron to potentially control, but I don't know what the reality is of that. All I know is that early waves of consolidation swept away a lot of local media, newspapers, and TV both that I cherished, leading to a more homogenized culture. Even more homogeneity can't be a good idea, can it? End quote. So that's some comments. I'll quickly check the Twitter page, see if anything new has come in since the start of the program here. Looks like no additional comments, but of course, if you have any, I'll mention them next week on the program, or I'll post on the Media Geek website. Give me your response, twitter.com/MediaGeek, on this issue of will more consolidation actually save newspapers? And of course, Eric has the other question. Are a lot of them even worth saving?
Well, and I do think they are. I think most of them probably are. But and at the same time, I think most people will admit that so long as there's creative control, so long as there's editorial control, that should be the focus. That's what you're saving. So if you're going to lose that anyway, in that case, probably wouldn't be worth it.
And it seems like it's a thinner and thinner margin. It's a tougher and tougher distinction as we watch these things go down. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Bonnell, and I'm your host. Eric Erdell today is producing and is at the controls. And check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. That's home to the Media Geek blog. And right now there are show notes up there, so links and stuff, so you can follow up on your own to a lot of the subjects and news covered here on the show, as well as all sorts of other interesting items. MediaGeek.net. The radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. Download the MP3, subscribe to the podcast to get automatically downloaded to your MP3 player, computer, or listen right in your browser, however you like to do it. Whether you miss the show, whether that's the way you like to listen to it, radio.mediageek.net. Any comments about the program, of course, send it to me, paul@mediageek.net. And the Twitter feed. I guess I'm pimping that Twitter feed. Maybe I should get some stock in Twitter. I don't think they're selling it yet, but
just a matter of time.
And they're not making any money yet. But nevertheless, pimping the Twitter feed, as long as it's not making any money. Twitter.com/MediaGeek. Well, the FCC was pretty busy in this last week. They had a meeting, an open public meeting. And on April 8th, the commission finally launched its national broadband plan, which is supposed to bring high-speed internet to all Americans. The plan is to use $7.2 billion in stimulus money as part of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, and the commission must complete developing this plan by February 17, 2010. All right, they're nearly 2 months behind. So now the commission has a series of questions that are open for public comment. The issues up for comment include the most effective and efficient ways to ensure broadband access for all Americans, strategies for achieving affordability and maximum utilization of broadband infrastructure, evaluation of the status of broadband deployment, including the progress of related grant programs, and how to use broadband to advance consumer welfare, civic participation, public safety, homeland security, community development, healthcare delivery, energy independence, and efficiency, education, worker training, private sector investment, entrepreneurial activity, job creation, economic growth, and other national purposes. And that's a lot. That's a lot of national purposes. But really, as it is with all such things, the devil is really in the details. And so when you drill down in the notice of inquiry, which the FCC is the official document out there, detailing the things, the questions that the FCC wants both the members of the public and people from industry and other groups to comment on. And so some of these more important details go down to even like the very definition of how we should define broadband. They say, quote, to the extent that broadband is defined by speed, should the commission consider raising the speeds that define broadband? Should we distinguish among the various broadband technologies? Sounds like a small question, but it's a big one. Because right now, the U.S. ranks about 15th in the world in broadband deployment. Some of the top countries like South Korea and Japan deploy broadband to your home with speeds of 100 megabits or more. By comparison, most people on a cable modem or DSL receive 1.5 to 3 megabits. Some people on some of the high-speed fiber networks are getting 10 or more. The difference there is the difference between getting relatively crappy video or getting high definition. It's the difference between taking an hour to download some software or operating system updates or taking seconds or minutes. And the U.S. falls pretty far behind in that. So if we continue to call relatively low speeds, and I think currently speeds of something like 500 kilobits per second, which isn't very much, is considered broadband in this country. And so here it is. It's fundamental here, looking for comment, the FCC is, on what we will actually consider to be good enough internet access in the U.S. Other questions include, should we define broadband in terms of bandwidth and latency, capability to download certain type of media in a certain amount of time, ability to access a certain online service or operate a certain application without depreciation in quality or by some other metric? Meaning, what good is it if your broadband poops out on you halfway through a download or in the middle of what you're doing? If, sure, in bursts you seem to get some good speed, but it's not consistent enough to even watch a full television program. Also, should they vary the definition depending on whether you're using a wired or wireless service, whether you're on a cell service or 3G service, or you're on DSL? Also, when they're considering the deployment of broadband, when they're considering whether a neighborhood, a town, an area has broadband internet, whether a certain class of folks have broadband internet, should they take into account the fact that maybe someone's got a Wi-Fi hotspot around? Is that good enough? Or should broadband deployment really be considered by whether or not people have actual wired high-speed internet right into their home? You can see, I mean, you know, anyone who might have lived in an apartment building, especially in denser areas, a lot of times you turn on your laptop and you can see Wi-Fi hotspots from all your neighbors. And sometimes if you move the laptop around just right, you get some internet because your neighbor downstairs has his Wi-Fi hotspot open. And then you turn it on the next day and you can't find it. Does that count as broadband? Or is it broadband when you actually can afford to get the DSL or cable modem service? Because it is a matter of economics. Fundamentally, the FCC is looking for these comments, and anyone from the public can actually comment to the FCC. It is not the most straightforward of processes, but there is a web form at the FCC website, fcc.gov, and you have until June 8th of this year to submit your comments, and then they have a reply comment date. That means you can go through, read other people's comments, and reply to them. Say it's BS, say it's great, take them apart, and those comments are due July 7th. And another issue out there is to what extent internet freedom, what we call network neutrality, will be built in to the deployment of broadband, especially broadband, which is deployed using stimulus funds. Interim Chairman Kopp said, quote, ensuring broadband openness, avoiding invasions of people's privacy, and ensuring cybersecurity are three such challenges that immediately come to mind. We have never in history been so dynamically and potentially liberating, have seen so dynamic and potentially liberating a technology as this, but history tells us that no major technological transformation is ever a total, unmixed, problem-free blessing. Indeed it is. So people will be commenting, and don't think for a moment that the likes of AT&T and Comcast and Verizon and Quest won't be submitting their comments saying, we should be able to manage our network however we see fit. Don't look at the man behind the curtain. And don't think that a lot of folks, a lot of companies, don't want to make sure that broadband continues to be defined as mostly pretty narrow. But the public does have a potential voice here, and you can overwhelm the FCC with it. So I'll probably get into how to do that later on future programs, and you'll certainly see links to that on the Media Geek website. At the Media Geek website is MediaGeek.net, for Pete's sake. I'm not the FCC. And believe me, you don't want me to be the FCC. So that brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, check it out, Media Geek Online. MediaGeek.net, home to the Media Geek blog. And our radio shows at radio.mediageek.net. And of course, if you've got any comments, I want to hear them. Send them to me by email, the new snail mail, paul@mediageek.net. If you use Twitter, go twitter.com/mediageek and tweet. And if you watch the Twitter feed or you watch the Media Geek website, I'll have some questions about pressing issues in our media environment. I'd love to know what you think and talk about it here on the air. Thanks for tuning in.